A warm welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in to our broadcast. This is Henrik Palmgren coming to you from the west coast of Sweden, up in Scandinavia. Our radio program is available around the globe, wherever internet is available, through our website redicecreations.com. I suggest that you visit often and follow along in our news section. Check out our forum and use our website as a research tool. We have many links and resources up there for you to explore further. And if you want to have full access to Red Ice, I suggest that you become a subscriber. We have a growing radio archive with subscriber interviews going back to about a year. We also have our first brand new short film production available now in our new member section. It's called Longevity and the Grail, and it explores the subject of life extension technologies, some of the people and companies that are involved in the fields of DNA research, cloning, gerontology from an esoteric perspective. And we're very proud of the production, and if you're interested in those topics, this is definitely something you want to see. So head on over to redicecreations.com and take a look. Alright, today on our radio program we are going to talk about everything from UFOs and the supernatural to the Nephilim, the Bible and prophecy. Our guest today is Lynn Marsouli. He has researched the occult and UFOs for over 20 years and he is the author of the best-selling Nephilim trilogy. He was awarded an honorary doctorate from Pacific International University for the Nephilim trilogy. His latest book, a non-fictional work unlike the Nephilim trilogy, is called Politics, Prophecy and the Supernatural. And I'm looking forward to speaking with Lynn about all of this and much more today. Lynn's website is spiraloflife.com, where you can read excerpts from his books and find much more information about his work. So let's bring on our guest here. Welcome to Red Ice Creation, Mr. Marsouli. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Henrik. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. I'd like to begin the program to talk about you and your background in this field. This is always an interesting perspective to hear how people get into this, as it were. When did you begin researching the Nephilim, and how did this come about?
Well, it all started really, if you go back to when I was about 13, I was in Boy Scouts, which is an organization we have here in the States, and you probably have a similar type of organization in Sweden, but basically it's kind of like Boy Scouts, or they go out in camp and learn knot tying and, you know, how to survive in the wilderness and stuff. And we were out on a camp out at a place in Rising Sun, Maryland, where the scoutmaster had set up camp, and we were taking a shortcut. And when I say we, there's three other boys plus myself for a total of four young kids, 12, 13 years old. And the day was like a late spring day. Pretty sure it was late spring, and the sky was deep, deep blue, and we were down in this little kind of a wash, a dry ravine type of thing. Only it would only have water in it in a storm type of a thing. And we were hopping up this. It was a shortcut back to camp because it was time for lunch, and we were all hungry. So we're running up this little shortcut, this ravine, and all of a sudden the boy stopped. The lead boy goes, "Wow, what's that?" And he looks over. And the other boys start going, "Whoa, what is that?" And I'm the last boy to look, and I go, "Wow, where?" And they go, "There." And they point, and I look up, and there is literally the classic silver disc. And this is probably circa 1962, between 1961 and 1963, somewhere in that time frame. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to go back and pinpoint it exactly, but sometime between 11 and 13 years old is when I saw this thing. And it literally was the classic UFO. Silver disc, all alone, just sitting there noiselessly. And I would say it was about the size of between a pinky nail and a dime, somewhere like that. So we had a good shot of the thing, and it lasted probably, I'm going to say 15 to 20 seconds, maybe longer. And then it shot, what amazed me about this, Henrik, is it shot straight up into the air and out of sight, like literally in a twinkling of an eye, it was gone. Hmm. I write about this whole experience in the book Nephilim, which is, of course, a fictional work, but I take that experience and weave it into the story of the first book of the trilogy, Nephilim, and it's you know, you can read it there. It's more verbatim, more fleshed out than what I'm saying now. But bottom line is, we ran back to camp, screaming and yelling. We saw a UFO, and we were immediately the brunt of cool jokes and lots of ridicule from all the skeptics. And by the evening, the other three boys had completely recanted their story and would not talk about it, said we didn't see anything, and I was just flabbergasted at this. It was really my first lesson in herd mentality, how when people will deny what they see if they're ridiculed to go, you know, along with the herd. And of course, we see exactly this apparently from witnesses at the Roswell crash. I'm jumping way ahead of myself here, but you know, from into the Roswell crash, where witnesses were threatened and ridiculed and told that they were crazy and all sorts of things. And we see it even later on after Roswell, the same type of tactic being used by the United States government more recently, and specifically with the Phoenix Lights. For those of you in the audience who don't know about them, there was this huge manifestation. This thing was just a huge craft and flew over the city of Phoenix and was literally seen by thousands of people witness this thing. Many eyewitnesses, obviously, and it was noiseless. It was huge. The craft was just huge. And later on, the governor of Arizona came on with a press conference, and this is what they did. This is just typical, and it just shows you that these guys are told what to do. And I'll tell you the reason for that in a second. But getting back to the press conference, the governor had someone dressed up as a gray alien running around the stage.
Yeah.
They all yucked it up and just poked fun at this thing and laughed and, oh, you know, these people are crazy, blah, blah, blah. Well, now fast forward, this is back in the 90s. Fast forward to several months ago on Larry King, which is a show we have over here. You probably have it on cable over there.
Yeah.
And on the show, which is really interesting, they had George Norrie, they had Jesse Marcel Jr. For those of you who don't know, Norrie heads up Coast to Coast AM, which is the second largest show listened to by anyone in the States, and it's, of course, worldwide on the Internet. Jesse Marcel Jr. is the son of Jesse Marcel Sr., who allegedly, and I believe this man, handled the UFO wreckage at Roswell crash in 1947. So he was on the panel. Stanton Friedman, of course, was there, and Mr. Friedman has written numerous books and appeared all over the place and is sort of the if I dare give him this title, but sort of the godfather of ufology in a way, highly respected by all, and a wonderful man who really does due diligence when it comes to research. And lo and behold, in the second segment, guess who shows up but the governor of Arizona, who held this goofy press conference. And what does this man do? The first thing he does is he apologizes to his former constituency. He's no longer the governor of constituency in Arizona, and apologizes to them for treating the subject of the Phoenix Lights, which is what the manifestation was called, too lightly. And then he proceeds to tell national television, in front of an audience of, you know, probably a 500,000 people tuning in, that he, in fact, was in Phoenix and also witnessed the craft. And here's the kicker. And what I saw, I'm basically quoting almost verbatim, what I saw was not of this world. So you see that there's a real disparity, a real flip-flop in the man's point of view.
Well,
from the press conference to, you know, almost a decade later where he admits he saw it. Very interesting.
Any ideas why his behavior is like this, flip-flopping like this?
Well, I think he changed his behavior because he's no longer a governor and doesn't have to sort of kowtow to the political elite in this country, which is trying to desperately keep all this under wraps. This could segue into a story which appeared on my desk this morning. Here in the States, we have Congress, and in Congress, it's split up into two governing bodies. One is called the House of Representatives, the other one is called the Senate. And this was, I believe, at the House. And basically, this man is reading this bill. It's called Homeland Terrorism Preparedness Bill. And to cut down to the chase, he listen to what he says. I mean, it's all classified. So when he's reading it, he uses the word classified because he can't say what's actually printed. So, for instance, he'll go, "This funding shall commence in conjunction with the first attack on classified or the first large-scale outbreak of classified, depending upon which comes first. You can actually go see this on YouTube, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Air Force units may also be directed to combat said classified due to their enormous size and otherworldly strengths. Gee, I wonder what they're talking about. Should casualties exceed classified, body disposal action shall be halted and associated resources shall be relocated to classified, underground, classified, protected birthing centers. A new Bill of Rights shall be drafted and approved by classified. What he's talking about, in my opinion, is a large-scale war from extraterrestrials. That's what he's looking at. That's what this bill's about. I can't prove that, but, you know, fill in the blanks. In fact, in one part, he says, should event occur in urban areas, and then he kind of goes, Jesus, that's classified. Far surpassing our darkest nightmare.
Hmm. Wow.
So, you know, what I, and this, of course, goes into what my book is about, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the revealing of the so-called extraterrestrial is going to be tied in with a war that has been prophesied 2,500 years ago and found in ancient texts, also in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but specifically coming from a book called Ezekiel 38, chapter, the book of Ezekiel, chapter 38 and 39, where it discusses this confederacy of nations which goes up against a land of unwalled villages. And what your listeners need to understand is in the ancient world, 2,500 years ago, there was no such thing. It didn't exist. A land of unwalled villages was simply unheard of. The first thing you did if you wanted to survive was build the highest, thickest, strongest walls you possibly could and reinforce those possibly with a moat and all sorts of other defenses. So when the roving hordes of Genghis Khan or whoever or the Assyrians or the Babylonians were attacking you, you at least had a fighting chance to save your people, because once they got in the walls, of course, we all know they would rape and pillage and, you know, kill the men, take the women, and take all your goods.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's how warfare was fought. So the fact that this prophecy speaks of, and it tells us, it says in the latter days, that actually the prophecy pinpoint is very specific, unlike some things of Nostradamus and other so-called prophets, which are very vague at best. This tells us specifically the time frame. It tells us that the nation of Israel would be regathered from the four corners of the earth, reestablished in their ancient homeland, which, of course, we actually see happening in Ezekiel 37 in 1948. Israel became a nation, which is completely unheard of in all of world history.
Exactly.
So that part of the prophecy is fulfilled. And then 38, 39 is coming up against a land of unwalled villages in the latter days in the end times. So I think when that prophecy is fulfilled, this will touch and trigger the supernatural manifestation of these UFOs, which I believe will be global and will happen simultaneously.
There we go, yeah. This reminds me when you're talking about this report here. Very recently, Paul Hellyer, the Canadian defense minister, went out.
I saw that on YouTube.
You did, yeah, exactly. Again, we have
fascinating.
Very fascinating. Talking about even setting up a kind of defense base, probably on the moon, and that this has been discussed within the Bush administration. What's your thought on this?
Well, I mean, not everyone is walking, you know, lockstep. France has come out and talked and released some of their UFO files. Mexico recently has released their UFO files, where they've actually caught discs on infrared camera and radar. So it's not swamp gas. It's not swamp gas. It's not, you know, it's not a weather balloon. I mean, but the deal is this, and just think about this, Henrik, and I hope your listeners really travel in this for a second. When it finally manifests, everyone's worldview is going to be instantly changed, okay? Everybody's worldview, it's a new paradigm, it's a mega lever in consciousness, which is going to happen. So they're holding this thing down and holding it for dear life, because they know once it gets out of the bag, everything changes, and in the States, it'll probably cause mass panic, well, really globally, for the most part, it's going to cause mass panic. And here's what I link it to. The Fatima apparitions in 1917, and I need to give your listeners backstory on this so they have an idea. This again is all talked about in my new book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. So I'm kind of jumping around different sections of the book as we get into this thing. But in 1917, a supernatural manifestation occurred in Fatima. Now, pretty much we can all agree on that. Something supernatural happened. The question is, what were we looking at? what was it really? The Catholic Church has claimed that this was an apparition or a manifestation of the Virgin Mary. I beg to differ, and before I get into it, my caveat is that I'm not Catholic bashing or anything else. I have no intention of doing that. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that I think we need to really look at what the eyewitnesses who were there talked about and saw, and were in fact, we were set up for some sort of a deception. Is this a harbinger, a precursor, a dry run, if you will, of what is literally coming on the earth eventually? And of course, I'm from the camp that believes that this manifestation was not the Mary of the Bible in any way, shape, or form. It was literally a deception that was a mega lever and changed the paradigm of everyone in that field in 1917. The story goes simply like this: two shepherdesses and one shepherd boy had this apparition. They were communicated telepathically by this small entity, which they at first didn't know what it was. And it appeared in a very short skirt, which was just really bizarre for that time. That would have been considered incredibly immodest dress in 1917. So the, whatever this thing was, it appeared to be a small lady, about 3 feet tall. The apparition, or whatever it was, never moved its mouth. It was very rigid and would kind of come from the sky and then float and hang over the oak tree where the children would see this thing, and it communicated to them telepathically. It never called itself the Mary of the Bible, at least not at first. Later on, that was kind of tagged on and added. And of course, the visions of Fatima, allegedly the prophecies of Fatima, were supposedly Russia and World War I and World War II. That's open for debate, and there's different scholars who look at it and say different things about it. Certain priests at the time who were there that were very much, you know, aware of what was happening, looked at it and questioned it and actually believed that what they were looking at was some sort of a demonic manifestation. Hmm. Cut to the chase without getting because I can get lost into that for the next couple of hours, but you cut to the chase for your audience. The clergy asked for a sign. They said, hey, go back and tell whatever this apparition is to show us a sign. So they go back and they ask the apparition, you know, give us a sign. And the apparition says, okay, next month on October 13th, which, by the way, was last Friday, and we just passed it. Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. When was it actually? Last Saturday, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And a month later now, word has traveled in this small town of Fatima, Portugal, in 1917, and there's 70,000 people, 70,000 people that are there in this field awaiting whatever this sign is going to be. They're not told what the sign is going to be. They're just waiting for it. Mm-hmm. And the apparition says that at 12 o'clock the sign will happen, okay? Mm-hmm. The first thing that I find incredibly spurious is 12 o'clock comes and goes and the apparition doesn't manifest. In other words, nothing is there. And the people are standing out. It's been raining all day. There's been a light rain. The field is very muddy. Everyone is sopping wet. There's pictures of that. You can actually see a sea of umbrellas, and 70,000 people are gathered awaiting whatever's going to happen. Hmm. The cross-section of humanity, the press is there, the clergy is there, atheists are there, communists are there, soldiers, bankers, peasants, men, women, young, old, kids, everybody, good cross-section of the populace in Portugal at the time. At 1 o'clock, the kids go, there she is. Now, the people gathered in the field don't see anything, but the children do, and of course, they immediately kneel and look at this manifestation. Shortly thereafter, what is described as, or what has been called, the miracle of the sun, which in my opinion is no miracle at all, but is a manifestation of a UFO, mm-hmm. Begins to manifest. And what witness after witness, when you go back into the record, describe, and you got to remember this, that at the time, there was no verbiage for UFO. Those terms, UFO, flying saucer, flying disc, would be used in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s. That's when those terms were first coined. So it's not in a lexicon in 1917. Hence, people don't know what to call it. So when you read the transcripts of the actual eyewitnesses, this is the kind of things that we say. And I'm paraphrasing here, but it's accurate. It's accurate to, you know, I would say over 90%. I'm not adding anything. Mm. People look up, and one witness says, I saw a dull silver disc. Another person says, I saw a disc that was spinning. Another person, we saw a spinning silver disc We looked up and saw a dull gray disc. We looked up and saw a metallic disc. Disc, 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 over and over and over again by all these people. And I think if, Henrik, if you and I, knowing what we know now, were standing in that field or could transport ourselves into 1917, we'd stand and go, oh my gosh, a UFO. Of course, the sun did not fall from the sky. The app, whatever this thing was only locally in Fatima. Several miles away, 15 miles away, they saw nothing. They saw absolutely nothing. The sun was in itself in the sky. Nothing happened. So whatever this was, it was local. And what was happening is, I would suggest that this disc was probably a mile-wide disc that was in front of the sun. Huge disc. And it began to descend. It began to wobble on its axis. And as it descended on the crowd completely, utterly panicked, screamed and yelled, fell to their knees. People thought it was the end of the world. Then the disc, when the disc came down low enough, there was like a yellow ochre light that kind of bathed everyone, dried everyone off. The earth was dry, and then up it went. People reported healings. So in my opinion, this is literally a harbinger, a dry run, a precursor of this kind of manifestation, which is coming on the earth. And it's interesting that the present Pope Ratzinger, Benedict, who at the time was called Cardinal Ratzinger, in 1980 apparently read the Third Secret of Fatima. Now, the Third Secret of Fatima, again, I talk about this in my book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, but the Third Secret of Fatima has, I believe, has never really been revealed. I believe it's very apocalyptic in nature. He had read it, I think, in the 80s or early 90s. I'm not sure exactly which decade, but right around in that period of time where he's still cardinal. And says, yes, it's apocalyptic, and it's very, he believes in it, and he talks about it. Well, after he becomes Pope, he completely flip-flops, distances himself from it, and says, well, Fatima was from another time, which begs the question, why would he completely distance himself so radically like that? And in my opinion, and I did some research backstory on this, and I found what I believe might be some smoking guns which point to the direction. I believe that there's a cabal of elite people on this planet, and this, of course, gets into the whole Illuminati stuff.
Of course.
But that Illuminati is really a luciferic cabal, and the subtitle of my book is The Coming Great Deception and the Luciferian Endgame. And what we're looking at is this entity, i.e. Lucifer, who at one time was a very good angel at one time, but obviously got a little twisted, and he's a super scientist. He's been around for thousands of years, and he has an end game. And part of this end game is to create this one world, new world order, as George Bush Sr. talks about. Mm-hmm. And that's where the thing is headed. That's where it's rushing. And I believe that, of course, that is a new world order, an Illuminati. So is Benedict Illuminati? I have no idea. But I find it interesting that if, and here's my scenario, and I'll stop after this. Here's my scenario. What if Benedict realized or was finally brought in, let's say, on the Inner Circle, and they showed him film, and they said, look, this is what Fatima was. We can't say that Fatima was a UFO because we can't go there. We can't discount it either because we've already said that Fatima, we already gave our stamp of approval on Fatima. So everybody's between a rock and a hard place. So what does he do? He just simply says this, Fatima was for another time in another place. And he distanced himself from it, and that's it. Now, that's all conjecture, but it is based on some research, and, you know, I'm never going to have an audience with Benedict, but I believe this, the same thing with, like, Bush said this the other 2 weeks ago, which I was just appalled at. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I voted for the man twice.
Really?
I distanced myself completely from him. He came out with the statement that if you're a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian, you're all praying of the same God. Well, if he had said that from any pulpit in the United States, Monday on a Sunday, on Monday he'd have no pulpit. It's just the way it is. I mean, you just don't say that. As Christians, we don't believe that at all. And, you know, obviously wars have been fought for this, so we won't go there. But, you know, there was certainly a lot of tolerance in this country compared to other countries for this stuff. But you can't say that, because I believe that you're not praying of the same quote-unquote God. But for Bush to say this, so it begs the question again, what does he know that he's not, you know, what has he been now privy to? So all this goes back to the one main point that they're waiting for this revealing, which, by the way, is the title of the third book in the trilogy, but they're waiting for some sort of event which I believe will hinge on this war in the Middle East, which involves Israel. And by the way, the second nation mentioned in this prophecy is Iran. So that just chills up your back, yeah.
Really?
Second nation is named Iran. It's right there, and it's bright and black and white. In the latter days, Iran is the second nation, and the first nation is Russia. And guess who was meeting this week? Putin and Ahmadinejad.
That's right.
I'm not making this stuff up, folks.
I hear what you're saying, and what I see here, and my kind of conclusions on all of this, because I'm totally in tune, so to speak, with what you're saying here. I see this as a kind of playing out of the Book of Revelations, basically, that this is used to some degree as a kind of blueprint, even for the people that are at the top. What would you say to an idea like that?
Well, yes. I mean, I believe that this is all ramping up to the Book of Revelation. That book is, I believe, first of all, much of it is very literal. And the events that take place that he talks about will happen on this planet. I'm not looking forward to that. I hope that we don't have to go through it. I'm hoping that in some way those who believe in let's say Yeshua HaMashiach, the second, you know, first century rabbi running around in Israel almost 2,000 years ago, and the experience of the early Christian church, I think that something will happen to us. I'm hoping that we're spared a lot of the nonsense that's coming down, but it is coming down, and it's obvious to see that things are, the stage is being set, things are rapidly closing in, and there's a paper actually which might become a new book, but it's called the Luciferian Dialectic, and a dialectic is basically it's a three-part idea, and that is you create a thesis which is then countered by an antithesis, and the end result, which is what you're trying to get anyway, is a synthesis. And we can look at the events of 9/11, and who or what pulled the trigger. And I'm aware of the conspiracies, and you know, Hitler burned the Reichstag, and I know all the parallels. And I'm not accusing the United States government of allowing this to happen. Not. I'm just saying that I believe that there's a higher evil component to this. Called the Luciferians, and it's deliberate. And basically it's this, that the thesis was the idea of the terrorists coming in. Then, of course, we got the Patriot Act, and some people would even argue the right of habeas corpus, which, in other words, you just can't imprison someone. You have to charge them with a crime. Okay? That's what habeas corpus is, and then you have to set that up. And some people say the whole Guantanamo thing is, you know, against habeas corpus. I actually attended a lecture, about a four-hour lecture with some of the greatest legal minds in the country, about the whole writ of habeas corpus and how it's being violated. And, you know, you can push and pull on that all day long. The fact that they are supposedly enemy combatants found in Afghanistan, you know, are they entitled to habeas corpus? But that's a whole different discussion. But getting back to the point of the Luciferian dialectic, you've got the 9/11 event, which then the counter or the antithesis is the ongoing war on terror, which then somehow shifts into the war of Iraq. But here's the deal. The war of Iraq may be deliberate by powers that we don't even see that actually segue into the Book of Revelation and prophetic utterances that happened over you know, thousands of years ago, millennia ago, that are affecting our day. And here's the outline for your listeners, and I think this will kind of blow them away, because you probably have never heard of this before. Where I'm going to go with this, this is kind of new. It's sort of my own theory, and I've been working on it, and the paper is going to be coming out very shortly describing the events that I'm going to talk about. in the country of Iraq is the ancient city of Babylon. Babylon is mentioned more than any other city in the Bible, and it's certainly, and prophetically, it's mentioned quite a lot. And other than Babylon, the only one city that's mentioned more is Jerusalem. So you've got two cities, Jerusalem and Babylon. We see Jerusalem in the news pretty much every night. I mean, there's just constant tension with the city of Jerusalem, which, by the way, fulfills a prophecy that in the latter days, Jerusalem will become a stumbling block for all nations, which is exactly what we're seeing today. Now, that didn't happen 500 years ago, but it's certainly happening right now in real time. And this tension in Jerusalem is unbelievable. When Saddam was in power, he rebuilt Babylon to the tune of close to $1 billion. He threw a lot of money into Babylon. Babylon today could be inhabited and rebuilt very quickly. And could be the capital of the new Iraq. Well, you say, Lynn, where are you going with this? Iraq right now, and we see it already happening. You just got to know where to look. But Iraq is not working. The government isn't working. They can't unify the country. The split between Shia and Sunni is a very real one. The sectarian violence, although it has been reduced, still remains under a very thin veneer of civility, and that civility is only created by the presence of the U.S. armed forces in multitude. So that whole thing is sort of a sham and a scam. The present-day Iraq under Saddam was ruled by the Ba'ath Party, but previous to that, it was actually part of the Ottoman Empire. In World War One, when the Turks lost, the British came in and carved up the Ottoman Empire and dismantled it. And what they did is they created the modern states of Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Iraq. Iraq was then ruled by the Hashemite king. The Hashemite king are descendants from Hashem. Hashem is the uncle of Mohammed. So the Hashemite king has great respect and great clout in the Muslim world. He commands authority because he's a direct descendant of the prophet Muhammad. In the about 50, 60 years ago, when the Ba'ath Party had a coup in Iraq, they deposed the king, who then fled to the present state of Jordan, where he set up the Hashemite kingdom in Jordan, where it resides safely and well today in the presence and under the kingship of Abdullah II. So we see that the Hashemite king is alive and well. He's very westernized, highly educated, was also, I believe, either in the British military and certainly served in the Jordanian military. So he's well-trained, he's well-educated, he's very articulate, very westernized. He's also a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, and he is a Hashemite king. Here's the scenario, and here's the Luciferic dialectic, and here's what, if it happens, this, in my opinion, we have watched a supernatural event manifest right in front of us. There are two things that happened just in the last couple of weeks that were on the wires. One was that the Israelis and Hamas decided to, during their final peace talks, that they would hand control of the Temple Mount. They would hand control over the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which, remember, is the holiest site to the Jews and the second holiest site to the Muslims. They would hand control of the Temple Mount to, anyone want to make a wild guess to who? The Jordanians, i.e. King Abdullah. Now King Abdullah would have control of the Temple Mount. He actually already has the keys to the Temple Mount, but the Waqf, W-A-Q-F, is actually in control of it, but they do answer to the Jordanians at the present time. So he's already in control of it. But what the Israelis and Hamas and carving up or trying to carve up Jerusalem and create a Palestinian state, what they were saying by this was simply this, that no matter what they would agree on, they both came to an early agreement that the Jordanians, i.e. King Abdullah, would actually have control of the Temple Mount. The next deal that was on the wire, which I just found fascinating, was the Jordanians have decided that they will dismantle the Palestinian camps and grant 90,000 Palestinians full Jordanian citizenship, thus creating a Palestinian homeland. Hello? So here's the deal. Here's the Luciferian dialectic. At the given moment, now those two things are already in place now. At a given moment, the King Abdullah will come into Iraq and set up a constitutional monarchy. They will give the northern part to the Kurds, and we already see that that's starting to happen. Turkey's already doing border skirmishes there. Central Iraq, I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. But the King Abdullah will eventually make his capital not in Baghdad. He will make it in Babylon and resurrect the city. Another interesting fact is that the largest department, a friend of mine, actually, on another radio show, Dr. Deagle, found this out, and he said that the largest deposit of oil untapped so far is laying between the border of Israel and Jordan on the corner of the Dead Sea. When they get to this, this will make the King of Jordan the richest man on the earth. All right? So he sets up his kingdom in Babylon, one. Two, he solves the Middle East conundrum, which has been going on since Israel became a homeland, by giving the Palestinians and creating the Palestinians a homeland. So now he rides in on a white horse, just like the book of Revelation says, and I believe that will be literal. He will literally ride in on a white horse and bring peace, but it's a false peace. The third thing that he will do is he will allow the Israelis to rebuild the third temple on that Temple Mount. Only guy in the Arab world who's got the clout to do it. He's the only guy who can do it. And what they'll do is they'll give them a portion. The Temple Mount, by the way, is 40 acres. So it's not this little dinky piece of real estate. It's big. It's 40 acres. And the King Solomon Stables and the Dome of the Rock and the Mosque of Omar, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, are in two different locations. They could erect a wall between the Dome of the Rock, right, and then have the Israelis build the temple. If he does all three of these things, which I believe he will, guess who he is? There's no doubt that he's the Antichrist, because it tells us that the man who cuts the deal with Israel in the latter days to rebuild their temple is the little horn, is in fact the Antichrist. So that's some interesting stuff for your people. If that happens, then we have literally witnessed a Luciferian dialectic of supernatural proportions. So that's some of the stuff I write about in the book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. That's where I go, and I think, you know, your listeners are hearing it first on your show.
Wow, very interesting. Definitely, that's a very interesting theory. And my mind, again, is drawn back to the fact that yesterday I was watching a clip. According to Paul O'Neill, Bush sought to invade Iraq 8 months before 9/11 happened. And what I've seen here, considering that the background, there are video clips now where we can see Saddam shaking hands with Rumsfeld and all of this. And I see that the U.S. Is going in now, have been there for many years, of course, but they are involved or the private companies to some extent are rebuilding Babylon, as it were, right now.
Right.
So I see all of this, that this is a kind of a... this is a global elite. This is a collective of people, and this is cross-border, cross-nation, cross-religion also. That's what I see.
Right. No, I concur. I can't prove it. I'd like to think that the United States government is a noble country, and I believe it is, and I believe that there are people who serve it and believe in it, but I also believe that some of it may have been hijacked by elements in this country which are strictly Illuminati and just evil. Now, I don't know who those people are, and we can, hypothesize on that all day long. So that's why I don't point fingers. That's for somebody else to do. I only know that, in my opinion, what we are looking at is the machinations of a Luciferian dialectic, and we are going to see some of those things. The real reason in Iraq, the reason why we went over there, is because the King of Jordan will eventually rise up and take control of the area.
So it's very
interesting.
That's an interesting thing to keep an eye on, that's for sure. And again, I tie this back to the fact that I think that there is a kind of blueprint idea here, that this is something that is being played out on one level or another, even if it's prophetic or has to do with prophecy, or if this is about men creating this scenario. But again, thank you for sharing that with us. That is a very interesting perspective indeed. Yep.
Sure. My pleasure, Henrik.
Okay, so let's return a little bit and talk about, again, let's go back and talk about the discs, as it were, the occupants of these discs, or if there actually are occupants at all in them. We could, talk about the more common UFO sightings that are rampant. These are, again, videos are coming out basically every day, new videos.
Sure.
Who are the people inside these crafts, or are there anyone in there at all? What's your idea here?
Well, the whole Nephilim trilogy is based on, and this is how I got into it, because someone once challenged me and said, what about UFOs? And having seen one, I had no answer in my worldview to how UFOs figured in to ancient scriptures and my own worldview and belief system. And after researching it extensively, discovering books like Dr. Thomas's book, The Omega Conspiracy, Pember's book, as in the days of Noah, and reading things like Josephus, and just really really getting into it and doing the research, I believe that what we're looking at is as other ufologists have put forth before, that these are interdimensional beings, and they come not from other planets or other galaxies, but from other dimensions. And this dimensionality is, in my opinion, the domain of what's left of the fallen angels that rebelled literally, well, thousands and thousands of years ago. I mean, I have no idea when, but in our far distant past, shall we say. Interestingly enough, I never understood why they would deliberately crash a saucer in Roswell, New Mexico. Now, David Flynn and I have conversed and chatted and emailed each other, so there's collusion there. But it happened after both of us had been published our books. That's when kind of we discovered each other. And I always had a problem understanding why the quote-unquote aliens would deliberately crash a saucer and lose their occupants. I mean, that just seems stupid. And, of course, Flynn pointed out that in the Book of Enoch, for those of you who don't know, that's a book that was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was also part of the Ethiopian Bible, the first book of the Ethiopian Bible. Mm-hmm. And in it, it talks about this manifestation of 200 sons of God, i.e. fallen angels, and where they come down to is Mount Hermon. Interestingly enough, there's a cult viewpoint which says, as above, so below, which is also biblical, as above, so below. You know, as it is in heaven, so it shall be on earth.
Yep.
And that whole area right now, when you think about it, is completely bollocksed up by three different countries. Mount Hermon is claimed by three different countries, Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. And it's a huge no man's land. So I believe that there was a portal there that allowed the manifestation of these fallen angels. There were 200 of them, literally thousands of years ago. What they did when they got here is they took for them whoever they wanted to in the female population for wives, impregnated them, and the offspring was this demonic hybrid called the Nephilim, or the Nephilim is the American pronunciation of it.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is Flynn postulated that if you were to go to the exact opposite side of the globe, of Mount Hermon, it would put you smack dab in the middle of Roswell, New Mexico.
That's right.
At the crash site.
And I think it's even on the 33rd.
Yeah, it is.
That's right. Amazing.
Which ties in with the Masons and the Illuminati and the whole deal. It's so deliberate, it's ridiculous. And here's the deal. The grays that we see are nothing more than biological manufactured kind of clone suits.
Wait. Back up there. Run that by us again.
The grays that we see are biological created clone suits that are inhabited by the disembodied spirits of a Nephilim from the flood. That's a mouthful. Here's my proof text for it.
Mm.
We know that in Scripture that fallen angels are just that. They're fallen angels. But that demons are not fallen angels. There's a definite difference between the two. Fallen angels can manifest pretty much at will when they're not restrained. Demons have to inhabit something to manifest, whether it's a person or a thing or a herd of pigs.
Mm-hmm.
You know that when Yeshua walked the earth almost 2,000 years ago, there's a story about him where he comes in and lands on the shore of a lake, and this demoniac comes up to him, and he says, immediately Yeshua says, silence, you know, and demands, who are you? And they say, legion, for we are many. And they beg Yeshua not to send this horde of demons which are inhabiting this man into the abuso, into the abyss. So Yeshua goes, okay, and they ask him, well, you know, can we go into this herd of swine? And Yeshua gives them permission. So this legion, literally a legion of demons, go into this herd of swine, and the swine go mad and rush into the lake and drown themselves.
Hmm.
So the proof text there, the reason why I bring that up, is it gives us a glimpse into supernatural things and the way this hierarchy of demons work. And they have to have permission, first of all, to do something, but we see that they inhabit something. In order to manifest in this dimensionality, they have to inhabit something physical, whether it's a herd of swine or a man. So here's the deal. Lucifer, or some people call him Satan, is not this funny guy running around in a Red Devil costume. I mean, this guy is a highly intelligent super scientist, diabolical genius that's been around probably for millennia, right? And so he knows that he just can't come in here and somehow manifest the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim. He knows he can't do that. But if he can clone something and provide a bio bodysuit, then they have something to inhabit. Well, you say, Chilin, that sounds pretty strange. Well, okay, how about this? for book one of the trilogy, I interviewed a guy from Amgen. He was a geneticist from Amgen. And I had no idea what I was getting into. I knew that part of the story, I needed to explore this. And so I interviewed this guy and met with him three or four times and, you know, wrote all the good stuff down. But I said to him, I said, look, you know, what's it like? What are you guys doing? Now, this guy is not some guy in an underground lab, you know, trying to clone God knows what. This is just a geneticist, right? Mapping the genome at the time and trying to figure out how genes influence people. And what he said is, well, we discovered that we now know the gene that makes a firefly light up. We know what that gene is. So they isolated that gene and spliced that gene into the DNA of a frog. Well, when the frog hatched and became an adult, guess what? The frog would light up in the dark, just like a firefly. So they're already screwing around with stuff that he knew about, and that's 10 years ago.
Definitely.
Right? That's 1998 when I'm doing research for the first book. So, I mean, this diabolical creature known as Lucifer, what must he know? What is he capable of? And that's the whole idea and the deal of creating these biological body suits, i.e. the grays, which are always, they always look alike, right? They're very clone-like looking, jerky motions, because they're inhabited by demons and they're allowed to manifest in this area. But make no mistake about it, they're incredibly diabolical. And that's the reason why the crash was deliberate. Because when they lose one suit, they could just hop into another suit, right? And here's another proof text for that. And I grant it, this is a stretch here, and I can't prove it. But Whitley Strieber, I think in Communion, it's either Communion or the book after that, he talks about being on board one of the ships and opening this weird drawer, and in the drawer are these like almost like shells of the grays, just stacked on one another. And he goes, what is this? I mean, they're there, but they're not, you know, they're not moving around, but they're like suits, which, and when I read that, that's what really triggered that whole theory of what the grays really are.
Wow, that's amazing, and it's very interesting that you bring up Whitley Strieber, because I just was going to mention that he actually talked about the breathing of these grays, that this was kind of robotic almost, the rhythm of the breathing was not organic in any way, and even the sound itself, and he have made a lot of these kind of descriptions that also made my, you know, my sense that something weird is going on here, something really weird, you know, this is not regular, you know, but I mean an organic life form, as it were. It's too vague and difficult to kind of pinpoint. So I think that you actually are onto something here, and this is even a guy called Credo Mutva actually talked about that. He saw that these grays were a suit basically for a lesser being that actually was inside.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is
really
fascinating.
Yeah. So I get into this in both the Nephilim trilogy and the new book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. That's where, you know, you can find out much of this information. And you know, it's Politics, Prophecy, and Supernatural obviously is not a novel, it's a treatise, and there's like 25 pages of footnotes in the back of it, so you can check the research, you can, you know, see where I'm pulling this stuff from. It's not rabbits out of my hat. I mean, it's backed up by articles and by research and books, and, you know, it's pretty thorough. So is it 100% right? No, nobody's got the whole story, but I think I've connected some dots other authors have neglected or just haven't been able to find.
Interesting. Do you think that the usage of suits like this for the potential demons or entities, whatever they might be, are occupying these? Is this a way for them to be in our space or on our plane of existence?
It's the only way these entities can manifest. They in other words, demons are disembodied spirits of a Nephilim. And what people don't realize is that it was a global flood. It had to be a global flood because the Nephilim were on the earth for about 400 years. Fallen angels were on the earth for 400 years. I believe that they were responsible for many of the megalithic structures that we look at and are perplexed about. During this incursion before the flood, specifically Baalbek. I mean, we can talk the pyramids till the cows come home, but I mean, you know, the idea of Zawi Hawass and that the Egyptians built the pyramids is complete nonsense in my opinion. But if you figure that the Nephilim during the first incursion before the flood, these guys could have been 20 to 30 feet tall.
Sheesh.
Yeah. We know that in the second incursion, after the flood, Goliath is at least 12 feet tall. So he's pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
Goliath is pretty big. 12 feet tall is a pretty big guy. Some people put him at 15. So he's between 9, the conservative put him at 9 feet, which is still way off the charts, and the, you know, the liberals would put him at 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
My idea is, what if during the first incursion, before the Great Flood happened, the Nephilim were between 20 and 30 feet tall? All of a sudden, the stone in Baalbek, the three largest stones ever put there by anybody. In fact, we have cranes today, and in my book I get into this and document it, that can't do it. And there's no place for ramps, and we're not talking slaves with pulleys and wheels and logs and all this other nonsense. It's just ridiculous. The logs would break. The logs would crumble under that kind of weight. It's just not going to happen.
Mm.
It's an absolute, I mean, even with the smaller stones of the pyramid, the idea of logs and ramps and pulleys and this sand thing, it's a total absurdity, complete absurdity. Logs break, you can't do it, it's 100,000 men and all this stuff, it's just a bunch of nonsense. You figure 20 to 30 foot Nephilim running around, it just changes everything. It just changes everything. It just makes perfect sense. Oh, I see. Imagine a 20-foot guy staring at you. Imagine what he can lift. How about if he has 20 or 30 of his buddies pick one of the stones that are at the base of the Trilithon and make up a Trilithon of a Temple of Baalbek? It's like the solution that they don't want to get into, because what it does is it figures in the supernatural. And, you know, there's a quote I use in the book, all through the book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And that book is this: the present political landscape is in direct correlation to supernatural events that happened, in some cases, millennia ago. I'll say it one more time.
Mm-hmm.
The present political landscape is in direct correlation to supernatural events that happened, in some cases, millennia ago. Here's the deal. In Christmas, or in the United States, we celebrate, and then you do too in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
We have, you like it or not, we have Christian roots here in this country. We believe in a Christian worldview for the most part. You can take issue with that, but that's why Christmas is a national holiday in this country. And 3 months later, most Americans celebrate Easter. We're talking supernatural events. We're talking the birth of this God-man, Yeshua, you know, 2,000 years ago. And then 3 months later, his horrible crucifixion followed by the glorious resurrection. All these things are supernatural events. These are supernatural events. The Israelis today believe in the Passover, a 4,000-year-old supernatural event in which the angel of death passed over the firstborn of the Israelis, killing the firstborn of the Egyptians, which finally allowed Pharaoh to say, okay, get out of here, and the Israelis left. They celebrate that year after year. For thousands of years, they've celebrated the Passover meal.
Mm.
So, you know, the Muslims do the same thing. They believe in supernatural events that happened to the Prophet Muhammad, and that's how they, you can look at nations like Iran, which are basically theocratic, and they, you know, they pray five times a day. Sharia law has been established, and that's what they believe in. And they believe in that because of supernatural events that happened, you know, 1,300 years ago. So the whole planet, like it or not, is, you know, indirect. The political landscape we look at today is literally in correlation, direct correlation to supernatural events that happened millennia ago. All you have to do is look at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and it screams. There it is. There's the conundrum. There's your proof text. There's all the proof that you need. Temple Mount built by the Jews, destroyed, rebuilt by the Romans. Cathedral built by the Christians, torn down, rebuilt, now called the Dome of the Rock. Hello? Is anybody listening? So, I mean, everything that we're looking at hinges on these supernatural events.
Mm.
And this begs the question, if the supernatural happened in the past, are we looking at yet more supernatural events? Are we looking at ongoing supernatural events on the planet? And are they beginning to manifest? And, of course, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural delves into that. And that's where I talk about UFOs and cattle mutilations, and induction phenomena, and crop circles, just to whet your appetite. And that's where I go. Because these things are supernatural, and they're manifesting not daily, but almost. Well, UFOs are daily. Crop circles aren't daily. Obviously, in the wintertime when there's no crop, you don't get crop circles, and cattle mutilation seem to be seasonal also. But UFOs are literally daily. There's a guy that I get updates from. He estimates conservatively about 10,000 UFOs. About 5,000 are reported a year, and there's probably another 5,000 he believes that aren't reported. So if we just take his numbers at 5,000 per year, I mean, let's just take the low number, don't even go to the 10,000. Let's do the math. You know, how many is that per day? So this stuff is ramping up. It's happening. Sightings are all over the place. And I have a monthly newsletter I send out, too, through email. And I did last month. I had a great interview on this couple that saw a disc and saw it for quite a period of time, going back and forth over the road between one field and another field, crossing literally directly over their car. Hmm. And they witnessed it for a period of time.
There we go.
It wasn't like a 10-second thing. They actually made a U-turn, came back, and the same thing happened again.
Really?
They saw this thing. No, they saw it several times. They were on the record. And that whole interview is in my newsletter, which you can get, you know, for a modest fee, and you can cancel it anytime you want. But it goes out monthly with interviews and of course, lots of updates from things that I see and you know, websites and YouTube links and all sorts of good stuff. So it's a fun.
Great. Definitely. Let's, you know, watch. I think this is a good place to round things off here for the first segment.
Sure.
Lynn, would you be interested in continuing our discussion for another 30, 40 minutes?
I'd love to, and I'd like to give you my website address.
That's, definitely.
Spiral of life. www.spiralofLife.com. SpiralofLife.com, and you know, pick up the book Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Or if you want, you can also sign up for the newsletter. That's what we encourage you to do, and get up to the minute stuff, and really enjoy it.
Yeah, there you go. So people, those of you who are interested in getting a copy of either Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, or the Nephilim trilogy, head on over to Lynn's website, spiralofLife.com. That's the main website. We will take a short break here, but we will return and talk more in the subscriber section. But for this segment, thank you so much for coming on, Lynn.
Really appreciate it, Heinrich. Thanks so much for having me.
And behold, a white horse.
There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up at the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup, or disappear into the potter's ground when the man comes around? Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Till Armageddon, no shalom, no shalom. Then the father hen will call his chickens home. The wise men will bow down before the throne, and at his feet they'll cast their golden crowns when the man comes around. Whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written down when the man comes around. Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes. multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. In measured a hundredweight and penny pound, when the man comes around. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death. And hell followed with him.